This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Hello, I'm Eric Savitz, Associate Editor for Technology at Barron's. Welcome to Tech Trader on Barron's Live, our series of live conversations with important players in the technology economy. I am excited today to have joined with me Gene Munster, who is managing partner and co-founder of Loop Ventures. Gene is a person who will be very familiar to all of you who are awaiting today's Apple announcement. Gene has been following Apple for a very long time. Before we jump into that, Gene, why don't you tell people a little bit about what you are doing, what you were doing, and then we'll get into the meat of the chat.
Well, still very close to Apple. I've got all eyes on that. I am one of the founding partners, as you mentioned, of Loop. This is a research-driven investment firm. We invest in late-stage private and public companies through a hybrid fund. And nothing has changed over the past, I'm not going to even frame in how many years it's been that I've been doing this. We do bottoms-up fundamental research. That's where we anchor. And to understand what's going on in tech, you obviously have to understand what Apple is doing. That is at the core.
So, you know, one thing I will mention before we get into the meat of this, when you talk about doing fundamental research, I should mention that one of the things that you have long done, and as we talked about the other day when we were preparing for this, continue to do, is literally count how many people are in line on the day that Apple launches new iPhones. Now, I don't know that this is as big a deal as it once was, but there was a time, of course, when you launched a new iPhone and people would literally line up at Apple retail stores for days and you were counting them.
Yeah, a lot of people would. We typically go to the same five stores. I remember kind of at its peak, you would see at the Fifth Avenue store, which of course is the marquee store, right. 2,000, 2,500 people in line. Quite remarkable. I remember towards the end of that, we continued to do it, but you know, at its peak point, you would see maybe three quarters of the people in line were paid to be in line. It was incredible. These people from a lot of them were not of kind of not born in the U.S. that would come here and get jobs doing that. It really marked a point where we started to think a little bit different about the trajectory of these lines. Mm-hmm. And ultimately is that what's most important is just to get a sense. And even though we can't line those up to, like, for example, a number, what they're going to report in the quarter, right. It does give us a sense about where things are going ultimately.
Yeah, I live in Palo Alto and in the Apple store on University Avenue in Palo Alto, which happens to be close to where a lot of Apple people live. It was about a mile from where Steve Jobs's house was, and Steve would occasionally show up in the University Avenue store on launch day. And people get super excited. And I think some of them were getting in line just to wait for Steve to show up. And now we see Tim there every once in a while. So let's talk about the new iPhone. So we're going to get the details on what we assume is going to be called iPhone 13 just in a little while, a little later this morning. But there's a little less excitement about iPhone 13 than there was last year with iPhone 12 when we had the first 5G iPhones. Sure. Some people talk about it as kind of what Apple used to call like an S generation, right? So where they would be like an interim, like between the 6 and the 7, say you'd have like the 6S. And I think they've stopped doing that kind of naming designation. But how do you feel about what we're likely to see in terms of features for the new phones, but also what demand is likely to look like? Because there's some concern that this will be a little bit of an off-cycle set of phones this time around.
I think there are two different conversations. From a feature standpoint, I think it's largely going to be mundane. You could position this as being an underwhelming type of a feature improvement. I think that it misses the broader investment point here, which is despite relatively modest improvements, whether it's with the battery life or the storage capacity or the camera, it's going to be the same screen sizes and obviously the same 5G. despite largely unchanged, I think it still is going to be lifted by the rising tide of 5G. And I think that this is an important multi-year cycle, and we haven't seen anything quite like it. When we went from 3G to LTE, we're going from, call it 20 megs down to 60 down. When we're going from LTE to 5G, we're going from, call it 60 to eventually the hope 5 years plus is a gigabyte. I mean, we're talking about exponential changes here. The reason why that's important is that it takes time for people to understand that. And we measure where we're at in the US, just to frame in, because I'm making the case that 5G deployment is going to be fundamental to the iPhone success for the next few years. But to kind of underline that, underscore that, is that right now their average 5G download speeds amongst the three US carriers are about 60 megabytes down for 5G. So it's fractionally above where 4G is. There is a layered cake approach, not worth our time to get into in terms of how 5G rolls out. Right. But it's safe to say that here's the punchline of all of this, Eric, is that there's about 400 million iPhone owners that have phones that are 3 years old and older. And the street's looking for 280 million phones for next year, for globally. And that base obviously is not all going to upgrade, but that aging base, it's not about what happens today, what's announced today. It's collectively how the phones improved over the last 3 years, and marry that with what's going on with 5G. I think this is going to be a cycle that's going to, it won't be the same 27, 30% growth we saw in the last year, but I think it will surprise investors on the upside.
Do you, when you think about the benefits of 5G, certainly we got more speed. People, of course, always talk about lower latency, which is particularly good for gameplay and if you're downloading video. But what do you see as the biggest fundamental benefits for the consumer in making the decision to go to 5G?
Well, you mentioned speed's kind of the, probably that captures initially what the consumer's excitement is around it. But ultimately, you're going to start to see some changes in the hardware that are going to use 5G more. So, for example, as you see more 5G-enabled mobile devices, they're going to capitalize on really using the cloud as the computing prowess of these devices. And so right now, you've got Apple's their X-chip line, which is great, but it doesn't compare to what, you know, an army of a cloud of servers could do in terms of processing. So right. I think from a consumer standpoint, it is going to be something where they probably don't think as much about 5G. They'll know that they like it and it's a little bit faster, but the experiences that they have on their phone, just thinking of something as simple as the search results you get from Google or how your photos are categorized from in your iPhoto app, all of those, how Instagram categorizes different stories. All of those are going to be progressively powered by artificial intelligence. I don't like buzzword bingo, but this is the reality of what's going to happen. And I think where 5G is important for a typical consumer is moving that to the cloud. And then there's the other kind of waves that come, whether it's augmented and mixed reality. I firmly believe that this is going to be a new way that we're going to interface. And then, of course, what's going to happen with electrification and the autonomy of transportation. And that, of course, needs 5G. And so I see this as just really a fundamental building block to the next wave of tech.
Do you so when iPhone 12 launched, one of the things that happened was some of the carriers offered very attractive incentives to consumers for upgrading, and which feels logical to me in the sense that all of the U.S. carriers have made extensive investments, invested billions of dollars in their 5G networks, and they continue right. to do that, whether it's just buying spectrum or building out spectrum. And then, of course, it's a little bit of a zero-sum game in that there aren't too many people left who don't have a smartphone. So do you expect that you'll see that again with this round, that you'll get, you know, again, like attractive incentives from the carriers to incent people to make the change?
Undoubtedly, I think we will. We will probably start seeing those in a couple of weeks. And just as you said, is that there's a logical benefit to the carriers to really push 5G. And the most logical winner of 5G, at least in the US, is going to be iPhone. It's about half the devices. And so that's an easy thing where they can put their marketing and promotional dollars behind it. And I think if you think about the lifetime value of a customer from a carrier's perspective, we're a long time away from those incentives ending. I suspect that they will go on for a few years, just because our penetration of 5G adoption is just so low. Tim Cook mentioned on the last Apple earnings call that there's only two countries that have 5G penetration at around 10%, and the balance is below that. Eventually, it won't be 100%, maybe it's 70%. But when you start thinking about the waves and the magnitude of that, I think you can build a case that it's in the best interest of the carriers to continue to be aggressive with promotions. And I think Apple benefits particularly from that, given their brand in the U.S.
So I want to touch for a minute on another topic, which is we had a major legal decision involving Apple late last week. This is the case where Epic Games, the company that makes Fortnite, sued Apple. They want the ability to have their customers pay for things within their games without having to go through Apple's payment platform, without having to get, in a sense, taxed by Apple with the 30% levy that Apple places on those kinds of transactions. They got sort of a mixed decision. On a granular level, the court decided Epic should have the ability to do this, to route around Apple. But the court also decided on a bunch of other elements of the case in Apple's favor. They said Apple's not a monopoly, that Apple doesn't have to allow sideloading of applications. The stock dropped some on Friday when this decision came out. The stock was down about 3%. And the interpretation was that there was some, at least at the margin, some revenue and profit vulnerability from this decision. How do you feel about this case? And what does it say about the future of the App Store, about the future of regulatory focus on Apple and its control of the app market for iPhones?
The case is
a lot to unpack there, Jim.
Yeah, there is. I'll start with, how do I feel about the case? It's significant. It is it's the first precedence that we have in the U.S. related to essentially these pending antitrust cases from the Department of Justice. And so every move by Judge Gonzalez-Rogers, every move that she weighed in on these 10 counts, I think are going to create precedents for the future. And as you said, it was a mixed result. And in fairness, there was some things that both sides felt good about and some things that they didn't feel good about. I think if you put it together, the steering piece, it was something that we knew was coming based on comments during the trial from Judge Gonzalez, that she had mentioned that wouldn't that be an easy remedy? And in fact, that she did cite for Epic on that. Mm-hmm. And maybe just to highlight what that means for Apple investors is that if you take the worst case scenario, and this is very profitable revenue that comes from the App Store, and assume that there is an effective campaign from these app developers to steer away from the App Store, it has somewhere between worst case scenario, 4% negative impact on earnings. It's measurable. Mm-hmm. I think the more likely case is a 1%. After a year or so of this, then the numbers kind of normalize and then we start growing again from them. So think of this as called a 1 year or 18 month headwind. Mm-hmm. But there was other pieces that were really important for Apple, some wins. We talk about they're not a monopoly. What does that mean? And ultimately, I think that the most substance came from the win that Apple had related to that Apple is not required to allow third-party app stores on iOS.
Right.
This is important because if just really quick for your viewers, a third-party app store, what does that mean? Is that you go into the app store, you download Eric and Gene's app store, and then within that app store, you can download other games. Essentially, it is almost like a Trojan horse. And that would evade Apple's payment system. That is a frictionless type of experience for consumers. And I think that that could actually create some long-term damage to their profitability. But she set precedents that that's not going to be the case in the future. And ultimately, this all kind of adds up to what may be a surprising conclusion from my end of all this, is that as it stands today, what really was on trial was the 30% take rate for large developers. That was the substance of this. And we had these other ways that they were trying to angle towards that. And of course, that stood, that is still in place. I do think that Apple is going to leave room for making further changes to that. In 2016, they lowered their subscription rate from 30 to 15% for the second year. And of course, they've made two changes over the past year, doing that now, that 15% for small developers. And my point is this, is that I suspect that developers are going to do a simple equation. They'll try to do it themselves and steer away from Apple. There's going to be a cost to that because they have to do the payment platform and they're going to right. lose some conversion. At the end of the day, I suspect the rate, the 30% commission holds for the next 5 years, but I wouldn't be surprised if long-term it drifts to 25%, probably doesn't go below 20%. I think Apple is going to continue to monitor the marketplace and see what numbers they need to have out there to make sure that they keep everybody happy in the App Store. Kind of a funny quick side point here is Epic paid their $4 million fine or $6 million fine today. They didn't waste any time paying that. Prompt payment concretes friendships, apparently. But they also asked for their developer's license back, which I think is indicative of kind of the strength that the App Store has, that despite what is bad blood that still exists between these companies and will for a long time, Epic wants to do business on iOS.
Yeah, one of the ironies, I think, of the situation at the moment is that Epic has filed an appeal. Apple, I don't think has said what they're going to do in terms of potential appeal. In part, I suspect, because some elements of the decision were so positive for Apple. I mean, the initial stock reaction was that this was a negative mm-hmm. for Apple, but because of these, you know, the way that the judge talked about these questions about monopoly and sideloading and third-party app stores, Apple may be pretty happy with the way this has turned out. We'll see.
Yeah, they may end up, I think it may end up filing. The one reason why I don't think they're going to file an appeal too is, like you said, is that the substance of this, I think, was in Apple's favor. And then separately is they have made changes more recently. They've been had significant encouragement to make those changes, but they have made changes more recently around steering twice in the last month, of course, based on some things that have gone in Korea. And this other class action lawsuit with developers. And so I think that they're, you know, it'd be kind of hard for them to appeal that. And then the judge would ask, why did you just make those changes recently? So I think that my guess is that they're going to kind of let this go and let Epic appeal the majority of it.
Interesting. Okay. So I want to talk about another hot topic for Apple, one which I don't think they're going to address today, which is the prospect of a car. Right. So we've seen there's lots as we've talked about, there's lots of smoke here in terms of who Apple has hired. And there's endless leaking of stories around who they may or may not have approached in the auto industry as a manufacturing partner. And of course, Apple has said literally nothing about anything involving cars other than like CarPlay or things that we know that they're doing. What is your sort of sense? How likely? What would you put the odds of seeing an Apple car in an Apple dealership or on a for sale on the Apple website? What do you think happens there, or is it all just sort of an experiment that's more likely to involve?
My mind shot forward to driving past a used car lot and seeing an old Apple car on the lot. Like, is that really going to happen? Maybe ask Carvana about used car lots, a different topic. To answer your question is I have to preface my answer with a cautionary statement is that I've been wrong on products that Apple has worked on in the past. Mm-hmm. I famously predicted that Apple would do a TV. They never did that.
Right.
And the lesson that I learned, and I need to remind myself of it, is that what Apple is working on doesn't necessarily see the light of day. If I was going to answer the question in the context, is Apple putting a lot of energy in this and does it look like that they're going to have their own car? The answer is yes. I would say 95% chance that they have their own car. If I factor in my learnings from Apple TV, I would say it's probably slightly better than a coin toss that they have their own car. Maybe it's a 60% chance, 51% chance. So I think that they are going to get there. It's a big opportunity. of course, they just lost Doug Field. Doug is was a talent at Apple. He went to Ford. He was gracious enough to give Tim Cook some time before that news broke to move over Kevin Lynch, who had done a great job with Apple Watch, over into that group. For better or worse, Kevin doesn't know a lot about auto. And that could, you could see that as, again, a negative or a positive. Fresh eyes can be a good thing. But it's safe to say also that Kevin Lynch is a star inside of Apple. And the fact that Tim put him on the auto project, to me, reinforces that Apple wants to do something here. And so I do believe it's more likely than not that Apple eventually does have a car. And of course, they're anchoring any sort of car that they need to go beyond just simple electrification. And that, of course, is going to be around autonomy and just around kind of the experience in car. And I think it's a huge X factor. If it does end up coming to fruition, I think it could be a measurable positive to Apple's valuation.
It's interesting, you know, the television example that you mentioned, because at least my sense there was that they got very close, that they almost did it. And I think my sense would be that they got to a point and decided, we're just not going to be able to make a TV that's better than anybody else's TV. That the ability to do, say, an Apple TV that is measurably better than a top of the line, you know, Samsung TV or Sony TV or LG TV, that it was not going to be a measurably better experience. And I guess, so to me, the question with a car is Apple going to be in position to produce something that's measurably better and different than, I think Tesla is probably the obvious comparison here.
I think when it comes to Tesla, I think it's going to be difficult to do something that's measurably different. I think Tesla eventually is going to have 20-25% of the global auto share, and it's their market shares today are all over the board. So I think if that's the standard, that's a difficult task because of just the progress that Tesla has made. I think if we use the standard against, can Apple do something better than the broader industry? I think that the answer is that yes, I do believe they have a more aggressive approach to kind of the consumer experience. I think the fact that they have the resources around both hardware and software, very different than a typical automaker. I think we kind of, I lump things into car makers. A typical car maker has, really what their key assets are, brand and a labor force that can put these together. But as far as the actual technology that goes into them, the majority of that comes from third parties. And so I think that there is an opportunity. That Tesla's different. They're more vertically integrated. But the simple takeaway is that I think vertically integrated auto is a big opportunity. And while I struggle with how can Apple make it just even a little better, I think Teslas are great. Don't own one. I think they're great cars. I think that there's an opportunity for them to run circles around the broader auto industry.
So I've got a couple of questions from readers that touch on questions around valuation and upside for Apple, right? Apple's already the largest market cap company. Well, I don't know if you don't count Saudi Aramco maybe, but so it's, you know, the $2 trillion plus valuation, $2.5 trillion. How do you think about the upside? Is there, you know, what's the case for $5 trillion, or I mean, how do you have to think about the valuation here to get excited about the stock when the valuation is where it is?
I think you have to ground it that this company's been around long enough that it will anchor. I think the valuation will anchor in earnings, and I think that's why you saw the movement last week with what happened with the Epic trial. And my belief is that in as we go out in a couple of years, I think the reality is the furthest you can see out is 2 years. So, and that is a stretch. But we look out to 2023, we think Apple can earn about $7 a share. So the street's loosely at $6. So we're ahead of typical investors. And then you have to assign some sort of a multiple to that. Now, this is going to be predominantly driven by the market. But if you assume a similar multiple as the market today, put a 28 multiple on that, you get to a $200 stock. And so, you know, maybe that view is not enough upside. Maybe 33% upside is not enough for some. That to me is something that they can do on their current businesses. It excludes anything with mixed or augmented reality, and excludes auto. And so to answer your question, I think that there's kind of a clear line of sight to $200. Maybe that's over the next year, year and a half. And then I think you start to progress to see how these other things. I hope to see a first mixed reality headset by WWDC next year. And I hope to hear more about the auto. And I think that kind of builds the case for above $3.4
trillion. Wow. So one thing that I worry a little bit about as I look at the streets numbers looking out to next year is there's the consensus is for a considerable slowdown in growth. Now, as we all know, the Apple had a fantastic pandemic, kind of weird to put it that way, but they saw a huge growth in demand for Macs and for iPads and almost for everything that they do. They just had a fantastic, they've had a fantastic run. The growth clearly was at a level that was not sustainable. They were doing, I think two quarters ago, it was like 70% growth in Macs and iPads. And some of the numbers for next year imply single digit growth or even flat to down top line. And do you think that's like overly pessimistic? I presume that you do, but how do you think about the, you know, longer term growth, you know, aside from the car wildcard element of the story?
I'm respectful to the physics of the law of large numbers. And when I see that big spike, I ask the same questions that a lot of investors and analysts are asking, like, is that really sustainable? I come back to this accelerating digital transformation, this shift that takes time. It takes longer than one quarter, two quarters, three quarters for people to retool the devices and hardware that they're using, the services for whether it's work, play, learn from different places, kind of these hybrid approaches. It's a tired theme, but I believe that it's going to continue to have a sustained impact. And I think that kind of the lift in all of this is ultimately a lot of that comes from the Mac, a lot of it comes from the iPad, and a lot of it comes from the services. And so I still feel that there can be upside. Growth is going to slow. It will slow dramatically next year. And I think, you know, we're going, as I mentioned, kind of 30% growth. I think it's going to be closer to 10% growth, where most investors are kind of thinking by mid-single digits. So yes, it will slow. I think it will be upside. And how do I feel about it is that this is it's a machine that innovates, it grows slightly, returns a lot of cash to investors. And I think that safety, it's something that is indicative of a stock that's going higher, because investors can rest well at night knowing that we're becoming progressively more dependent on their products.
So, you know, on this, you mentioned the fact that they've been returning a lot of cash to shareholders, which they have been very aggressive about buying back shares. And there's an interesting new wrinkle here, which is there's a push in Congress now to try and place a tax on stock repurchases, or in other ways, try and slow down stock repurchases by corporate America. This is based on the interpretation there, I presume, is that stock buybacks tend to benefit management or entrenched, I don't know, investors. I don't want to get into the politics of the question, but it does raise an interesting question for a company like Apple, which is if there was a deterrence to their ability to continue to repurchase stock aggressively, what might they do with the cash? I mean, you know, they've made a clear sort of vow to get to cash neutral. That will be hard to do in a world where they can't buy back stock. What do you think they would do?
Well, just to frame in, you know, their net cash balance. So they've got debt. I like to think of cash as what do you have after you pay off your debt? Right now, it's called $80 billion. They're generating about $60 billion a year. And so, as you said, is that what do you do with that? And the answer is that if there is if there is some change around that, I suspect that Apple probably initially won't do anything. I do not believe that they will quicken their pace of M&A, for example, start to maybe stretch to do some things. We can talk about what they potentially could do. I suspect that they'll probably wait a couple of years and just to see if there's any sort of change in kind of the political landscape that could reverse any sort of legislation around that. But if it seems like this is going to be around for another 2 or 4 or 6 more years, something like these types of policies, I suspect that they'll have to at some point, just in the fairness to investors, be more aggressive with M&A. And if I was going to guess, how does that kind of manifest itself? I think it would probably be, and things that a lot of investors would see as kind of boring, which is around vertical integration, tooling, whether it's something around auto or on the kind of building the frameworks for mixed and augmented reality. There's a lot of investment that still needs to happen there. Just listen to Mark Zuckerberg. I would say don't expect any changes over the next 2 years, but if policies continue and Apple just can't get rid of their cash, they're going to have to do something with it. And I think they'll be more aggressive at M&A.
Yeah, there's so little history. I mean, it's one of the fascinating elements of the story in a way that they've been so reluctant to do substantial deals. I think the last thing of any consequence they did was when they bought Beats, which is still a relatively modest deal and one which arguably was maybe not the most successful one. They don't talk a lot about Beats these days. I don't think we'll be hearing about them this morning, but where they have done some things is, as you say, are technology acquisitions, things that a bit, sometimes don't even get announced, small tuck-in kinds of deals. You'd have to do an awful lot of those to use up.
Yeah, you basically have to buy every startup out there.
Yeah, it's interesting. So we're running a little short on time, and I had other things I was going to ask you about, which we'll have to save for another day. But I do want to touch on one other thing, which is, you talk about, in order to move the needle for a company that's Apple size, obviously you need big opportunities. It's one of the appeals of cars is it's like a really big opportunity. Another area where they've shown some traction is in things that relate to health and wellness. That is particularly true around the watch and the fitness, other things. How do you think about Apple's opportunity there? How do you think about the size of that opportunity and the way that they're approaching it?
So I think the immediate opportunity is still just around the watch and selling devices. It's about 5% of Apple's revenue today. It grows at about 20%. And one more data point there, about 15% of iPhone owners use an Apple Watch. There's room for that to grow to be above 50%. The watch has a lot of factors. If you talk to a clinician, they would say the majority of them, with the exception of AFib, are for entertainment purposes, like heart rate, for example, or the blood oxygen indicator. And so for them to really progress, to answer your question, is what I'm looking for is for more of the features on Apple Watch to get a class 2 designation, which means that that real healthcare can start to embrace this. And I do think that even if it's a harsh representation of it and call it entertainment purposes, I do think it does benefit people's health undoubtedly. And so I would, we can fast forward to some of the reports about Casper and the initiatives that they want to do about kind of end-to-end healthcare. I think that probably is outside of the box where they ultimately are going to play. I think they're experimenting out there. I don't think that will ultimately see the light. I do think they'll continue to add things. I do believe blood pressure will be part of whether you like it or not, you're going to have an option to get your blood pressure taken on your Apple Watch. Mm-hmm. And I think that is probably the most significant, even though it seems like we've been talking about the watch and health and wellness. It doesn't have the same bang as them getting as a primary caregiver. I think that they should stick to hardware, software, and services. And I think they're going to do that. And I think we're going to see a new watch today that's going to have some more of those features.
Yeah, we'll see it soon. One last question. Apple has a huge relationship in China. They have a very large business in China. They distribute applications in China. They make devices in China. And I will say that Tim Cook has done a remarkably careful and capable job at managing that very complex relationship. Do you worry at all about Apple's situation in China, given some of the recent crackdowns by the Chinese government on various aspects of their own technology landscape. How much of a risk is that?
I worry about it from a manufacturing standpoint. Whatever 15% of their revenue comes from China, I think if that ended up hitting the wall, the stock would be down, but investors would get over it and just say, let's just forget about China and move on. A year later, the growth rates step up again. I do, from a manufacturing standpoint, I do think that the truth is several layers below the surface. And I think what's going on, I mean, you could even build some pretty complex examples about how the U.S. and China relationship is progressing to going below the surface around these tech companies. And I'm not a conspiracist. I think that there is a cold war going on. I think these tech companies are front and center. I worry about it. The one reason why it doesn't impact my view that this can be a $200 plus stock is that Apple still is the gold standard, and it is globally the gold standard in tech. And if the Chinese government does something to make it more difficult for Apple to do business in China on the manufacturing side, I think that would be really accelerated a downward trend in the relationship. It's kind of taking a blow at the prize of the U.S. tech industry. And I think that is unlikely that would happen. So I'm basically counting that cool heads will prevail.
And I guess we'll see. And we're going to have to wrap up. Gene, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We had lots more stuff that we were going to talk about, but we will have to save it for a day when we have more time. I hope everyone gets to listen in to the Apple call that's coming up shortly. Please join Barron's Live tomorrow. We'll have a fascinating interview tomorrow with a woman named Frances Ballantyne, who is a 97-year-old who was born into the Great Depression, moved to New York during World War II. She'll be talking to MarketWatch personal finance editor Quentin Fottrell to talk about her life experiences and her mistakes and smart money moves, how she's weathered various crises. Please join us for that. Thank you for being with us, and please stay safe. Thank you.